Welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Just over 40 years ago, Philip Roth's frank, sexually explicit comic novel, Portnoy's Complaint, was first published in Australia. What makes the anniversary so significant, though, is that the book, like hundreds of others, was banned in Australia as a publication likely to deprave and corrupt. Anyone found with a copy could be fined or put in jail. In 1969, the young directors at Penguin Books were arrested after they deliberately defied the customs ban on the book, publishing 75,000 copies and shipping them around Australia to an eager reading public. At the time, publishers, authors, radicals and lawyers were all fighting to liberate us from a strict regime of government censorship, plunging Australia into what the Governor-General Sir Paul Hasluck lamented was becoming a permissive society. Today's feature re-examines the Portnoy's case, but it also takes a look at other banned publications of the time, including the Little Red Schoolbook. And this little book was full of graphic information for teens about sex, drugs and politics, and its text controversially declared that all grown-ups are paper tigers. Today's program is called Prudes, Pervs and Paper Tigers, and a warning, it does contain some strong language.
Well, today has been police crackdown day on the book Portnoy's Complaint in Sydney. Police have raided at least three bookshops, including Angus and Robertson's.
What is lewd and suggestive is persistently thrust under notice of persons who don't want to see it, in ways that make it difficult for even the youngest and most carefully protected to avoid the contamination.
Sir, I'm from the ABC News. What do you intend to do with these books you've
confiscated? No comment at this stage, Sir.
At the airports, when you arrive back from overseas, they'd search your bag not for drugs, not for weapons. They searched everyone's luggage for banned books.
What does obscene mean? What does offensive or indecent mean? It's a subjective judgment of the individual.
What's wrong with a bit of porno?
Pornography, mate, cripples the human spirit and debases the coinage of true love.
Ah, bull's dung. Where did you get that from?
Sunday's newspaper.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Of course you did. Right under the picture of the naked bird washing the elephant.
Oh. It's hard to say whether we thought that we were going to win through on the censorship issue. It didn't really occur to us, I think, that we would back down.
Are you selling the book yourself?
I am.
What's the reaction so far?
Tremendous interest from the public. We've been selling continuously all morning, and it looks as if the addition of 75,000 will not satisfy the demand of the Australian public for this book.
It is about the effect of this material on the children that was laid upon us to treasure. They are to be protected from these things.
We cannot keep the library doors of the world closed against the incursion of children. And we cannot keep these library shelves free of books that may possibly be dangerous to somebody.
But, Minister, all I'm really saying is that in a democratic country, the people should be allowed their own choice about what they want to read.
Not everyone's as well balanced as we are, you know. That sort of stuff is bound to corrupt and deprave them.
They had a search warrant, you see, and we could obviously find 18 copies. They said, "Have you more?" I said, "You have the search warrant. You have a look around my premises." I might say it was a bit unfortunate. Patrick White was about to purchase his copy.
Be very careful what you say, Doug.
Yeah, no. Yes, I'm watching every word. Hold on. Was that rhyming slang?
No, word is all right. Good, you can fine. Say word.
For example, it's only 13 years ago when three words were banned. The three words were virgin, seduce and pregnant. I don't know whether society is any worse off today that these words are freely used. I would have thought it's much better because people can confront one another now with adult language and on adult subjects.
A live bum can upset and destroy an entire community. But a pre-recorded bum, an officially approved bum, by a responsible
bum inspector.
By getting carried away, Doug.
That's what happened on the show, Doctor.
The bookseller should have a responsibility. The television station, the radio station, the parent. and the individual. Governments should censor less and less and move more and more out of the field and leave it to individual choice. And I would have thought that's liberalism.
One of the jokes at the time was that if the Martians landed in Australia and read our books, they'd have no clue on how we procreated.
Writer Frank Morehouse. Before him, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore at the National Press Club in 1971. Pete and Dud were banned from live TV in Australia for saying bum. In that mix of voices, you also heard our beleaguered customs minister at the time, Don Chipp, the novelist Anthony Burgess, decency campaigner Mary Whitehouse, who, like Pete and Dud, visited Australia several times, the activist Wendy Bacon, and rebel Sydney bookseller Bob Thorborn. They were all caught up in what was an intensely serious and occasionally intensely absurd battle over censorship. It was a battle fought on many fronts: art, culture, TV and radio, but especially literature. It might sound strange to us now, but for decades up to the 1970s, the Australian government actively kept a secret list of banned books, a list which ran at various times in our history to 800 titles. Nicole Moore is an associate professor in English at the University of New South Wales in Canberra.
The banned list existed from 1901. Customs kept it as General Order 890, which was circulated to customs officers in their different customs ports around the country, notifying them of when titles were added to it and updated or removed, although that was much rarer. And there was public pressure for it to be released, but it wasn't released until it was published in the Parliamentary Gazette in 1958. So for all those decades, the Australian public didn't know effectively what was on the banned list.
So we didn't know what we didn't know.
That's right, exactly.
But in that period, were civil liberties organisations actively campaigning to know what was being censored by customs?
Yes, they were. Particularly in the 1930s, there was quite a lot of anti-censorship protest, and different organisations. The Anti-Censorship League, set up in the mid-1930s, which based out of Melbourne, was very influential, and arguably it did have some impact in loosening the sedition provisions as they were applied within customs and within the Attorney General's Department. They worked very hard around the issues of political censorship in that period, where communist, anarchist and even anti-fascist material was subject to censorship. But nevertheless, there are some obvious cases where it was clear that there were books on the banned list. For example, Huxley's Brave New World or Joyce's Ulysses, texts fated around the world but unavailable here. So it was clear that they were on the banned list, even though the banned list wasn't circulating.
Heaven help us, ma'am. Do you realise what you're saying here?
Well, naturally, sir, I realise the subject matter is possibly a little controversial.
Possibly? You're proposing the complete abolition of all forms of censorship.
Well, yes.
No point in sticking your neck out, is there? If you go around saying that people's wives and children ought to be allowed to read the sort of stuff you want them to read, the press will have you for breakfast, the opposition will have you for lunch, the voters will have you for dinner, and I myself will finish up what's left of you for supper.
In 1958, it all changed. Why did it change? What was the catalyst for the revision of the banned list?
Well, it was another of Australia's notorious censorship scandals that made things change. This particular one was around J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. There's a fantastic story about it, in that Harold White, who's then the National Librarian, the National Library of Australia, and he discovered a copy of it in the Parliamentary Library and had to take it off the shelf because, in fact, it had been banned for more than a year. But nobody in the Parliamentary Library knew, of course, because the banned list wasn't circulated. And this became a national scandal. So you had parliamentarians writing in, declaring this outrageous, even ministers of religion noting the fact that it was set for study in American universities. And it had also, in fact, been given as a gift by the American ambassador to some notable Australian politicians. So it was an instance where Australia was so clearly out of step with the rest of the world that force of public opinion was too great for it to stay banned. So it was reviewed and taken off the banned list, and the pressure from the newspapers and public opinion was so great that actually the then long-serving customs minister took the first steps to the first formal review of all the books on the banned list. So all the books on the banned list had never been reviewed formally from beginning to end. So the Literature Censorship Board undertook to do that for the first time. And the banned list itself was released in Parliamentary Gazette for the first time. Mm.
The list was reduced from about 800 books to 178. But this list was only of books considered by the review board to have claims to literary or scholarly merit. So there were still 178 literary titles banned in Australia as we headed into the 1960s. A testament, says Nicole Moore, to our unique status as one of the more censorious nations on the planet.
A.A. Phillips, the literary critic who served as a censor in the mid-1960s, makes the interesting case that, in fact, actually Australia was a worse censor than the rest of the world, effectively just because we could be. And that he talks about the way in which, as a censor, he felt compelled to ban, otherwise he wasn't doing his job. Because Australia's an import culture, every book they were looking at had already been assessed by the culture in which it was published, the British and American context usually. But we couldn't just take whatever they would give us. We had to have some sense we had some control over our national culture. So customs are very, very effective at drawing that line. They had very powerful legislation, including strong powers to seize that exceeded even those of the police. They were set up at the beginning of the 20th century as a way to make us a bounded nation, drawing the different colonies together. And arguably, because we had that strong legislation and we were in an import culture, we're in a situation where we could actively implement the kind of censorship that perhaps other cultures wish to but couldn't.
Mrs. Fisher claims that Mr. Sullivan is in possession of obscene literature which might be said to deprave a reasonable person within the meaning of the Act.
Ah, oh, rubbish, Sergeant. I'm a reasonable person and I'm not depraved.
There seems to be some doubt about that.
And it was a very, very elaborate bureaucracy, that the scale of which is really quite difficult to comprehend. But every port, even every airport, every parcel post had a customs officer whose job it was to police the banned list. In the early parts of the 20th century, the importations themselves were looked at, but in the later 20th century, when the volume of books grew so great, bookshops had to just put in their lists of books they were bringing in, their import lists, and customs would scan it, noting suspicious publishers, noting suspicious authors. And a customs official at a port did have the power to effectively ban a book on the spot.
The Mothers for Australian Decency are concerned about the moral decay which is rotting our youth. As you know, they are...
Well, what have you heard about the censorship in Australia?
In general?
Yes.
That it literally is the worst in the world, including South Africa. I mean, that's the hearsay that I get from other film directors.
We were more censorious effectively because we saw ourselves as an outpost of empire in the South Pacific, and in fact distinguishing ourselves in relationship to Britain as an outpost for Anglo-Saxon values and moral values. And you do see that playing out in the rhetoric of the censors at certain points, that Australia was, they call themselves a bulwark for Anglo-Saxon values. So there is that sense of Australia as a predominantly Christian, even Anglican nation in the early parts of the 20th century, and an ideal of a national morality becoming very central to a young nation wanting to distinguish itself as such, as a white moral nation in the South Pacific.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, what you've all been waiting for, the man killer.
The moment of truth has finally arrived.
The book that couldn't be written is now the motion picture that couldn't be made. Myra Breckinridge.
In the late 1960s, one flashpoint was Gore Vidal's satirical gender-bending novel, Myra Breckinridge.
I'll be right with you, boys. Get your resumes out.
At the time, Dennis Altman was a young academic and gay liberation activist, and his strong view then was that banning sexual literature was an act of political censorship.
What was happening is that books were being banned that had real political agendas and messages, and they were banned on the grounds that somehow they were sexually offensive. And I think the best example of that was one of James Baldwin's novels. And I think I'm right in saying Another Country. Now, Another Country was ostensibly, although, you know, who knows, was ostensibly banned because it talked too graphically about sex. And the story that went round was that Sir Robert Menzies, who was then Prime Minister, couldn't imagine his wife reading it. Although I don't know that Sir Robert Menzies actually ever read any of the books that were banned, nor why he would have as Prime Minister. But there you have a case of censorship on the grounds of moral purity, banning a book that was, of course, an enormously important statement about race relations, which was by far the the biggest domestic political issue in the United States. And I think there were a number of other examples. You know, you can think of a writer like, say, William Burroughs, whose books would have been banned. And then, of course, you certainly can argue that a lot of what was banned had an implicit political message in the sense of talking about individual freedom, freedom of expression and autonomy, which was not how the censors saw it. And at the time, I think that I fell into the anti-censorship struggle, if you want to call it that, sheerly by accident, because a book of mine was seized by customs, or two books, became the basis of a court case. You wouldn't be talking to me now if there hadn't been an overzealous customs official at Sydney Airport in either 1969 or 1970.
Okay, you said you fell into it by accident. It was an accident then. How was it an accident?
Well, it was an accident in the sense that I was coming back from the States and customs looked through my bags, and there were two books they decided to take exception to. One was a novel, which everyone's now forgotten, by Sanford Friedman called Totem Pole, and the other was Gore Vidal's Myra Breckinridge. And they seized those. I remember everyone being very polite. I think they just took them away and said, oh, we'll get in touch with you, sir, and you know, that was it. And one of my colleagues, and I'd just started at Sydney University, one of my colleagues was Ken Buckley, who was very involved in the Council for Civil Liberties. And I went to Ken and said, this has happened. And so Civil Liberties in New South Wales were looking for a case. And in a sense, I showed up at the right time. They had a case. And the case eventually wound its way to court, where one of the books, the now forgotten Totem Pole, was released. And the other one, Myra Breckinridge, was not. Customs upheld the ban. They still, I suspect, hold my copy, and I would like it back.
The court case run by the Council for Civil Liberties, with Dennis Altman as the figurehead, was a partial victory for the anti-censorship forces.
The very fact that it went to court, that the customs people had to justify it, that the judge found their justification insufficient in one case. But also, I would say, the ruling against Myra Breckinridge was so absurd that I think that also helped undermine it. Now, the reason I say it was so absurd is that there was a British edition of Myra Breckinridge on sale legally in Australia, and Gore Vidal had been told he had to remove some offending passages for it to be published in Britain. And that edition was available in Australia. Some of the passages that the judge found improper in the edition that had been seized from me were freely available in the legally available British edition in Australia. Now, you know, that is patent nonsense that you could read those same passages legally if the book came from Britain, but they were illegal if the book came from the United States.
They had a warrant to search the premises for copies of Portnoy's complaint. They also confiscated some copies. They found 18 copies and they confiscated them.
Were these the only copies you had?
They had a search warrant, you see, and we could obviously find 18 copies. They said, have you more? I said, you have the search warrant.
And so then you see Portnoy's complaint coming through as the next major book case. And that case was really extraordinary because that's the first time that publishers really took on Australia's censorship regime. So we saw a book that had been feted internationally published by Penguin on Australian shores to get around customs bans on it. So if it was published domestically, it wasn't subject to customs bans, but then it became subject to state-based legal regimes. And so Portnoy's complaint then went to court in almost every state of Australia, prosecuted as an obscene publication. And these made headline cases, of course, around the country, with notable writers like Patrick White and academics, Manning Clark, standing up to testify to the literary worth of this book in the courts.
Do you think you'll be prosecuted over this?
This is a possibility, yes. I can't be sure whether we will or whether we won't. The book has been very widely distributed throughout Australia. Many booksellers are selling it in the city. I think to do anything now may be closing the door after the horse has bolted.
At the time, distinguished publisher Hilary McPhee was just beginning her career as an editor at Penguin Books. She was one of just a few women in that world at the time of the Portnoy's case in 1969. Penguin was a young company in Australia, run by energetic and talented young men who were ready to take on the establishment, not just the customs regime, but the stuffy old colonial masters in London.
It was a climate that was terribly frustrating for publishers who wanted to not only make a mark, but to be part of the zeitgeist, to be very much out there. You know, we all were. We were part of the world where the pram factory was happening in Melbourne. There was a lot going on. There was the anti-war stuff. But the books that we were allowed to read were not the same books that could be read in America. They were not the same books that could be read in even the UK in some instances. So we had to do something about it. I was very much a kind of bit part player in this whole thing, but I saw it.
So what did you see? You saw some frustrated young publishers wanting to challenge
the system. Were no publishers. I was the nearest thing to a publisher. I was the baby trainee editor. Then along came John Hooker, who'd been working in Cheshire in Melbourne. But that was about the time that the decision to run with Portnoy was taken by John Mickey, who was the boss, and Peter Froelich, who was the financial director. They were the two senior people at Penguin at this time, and they were both very young and both very wanting a fight, I think.
Penguin had been seeking a strong case to test the Customs Act, and Portnoy's complaint seemed to fit the bill. At the Penguin offices, the campaign was designed in earnest and like a military operation.
Portnoy was clearly going to be banned in Australia. You had to smuggle books in those days. People read banned books, but you had the humiliating sort of exercise of smuggling them in. If you were going to publish them, if you were going to try and be involved in the publication of books, you had to think about how you could get them printed in Australia and bring in hard copies that you would photo offset from, because there was no electronic transmission of type. There was no internet, obviously. So in came these copies in brown paper bags smuggled in by people. They put false covers around them and tucked them into a Penguin box. I don't know how they got copies in. I can't remember. But there were several precious copies on John Mickey's bookshelf. And they were going to be the ones that were going to be photographed from. And the printers in Australia were going to be asked to do them. Now, that's when the great decision was taken to try and bust the censorship laws right open, because it did need a high-profile publisher to take a big risk on it, and it was a big risk. It was a lot of money and a lot of secrecy involved, a bit like the way Harry Potter was published, with the cues and the excitement and so on, but it was an undercover operation.
In my statement to the House, I said, as a philosophical concept, all censorship is evil. As John Milton said, it's rather like trying to impound crows by shutting the paddock gate. So it's an evil concept. Now, you go on to another philosophy, that is that we live in a democracy and governments must have regard to the wishes of the people. And I have no doubt that there's an overwhelming number of people in Australia who want censorship in some form. And you join the two together, and what I do is administer a necessary evil.
And Don Chipp, of course, was absolutely furious. It wasn't the right time to make a stir. I mean, the politics of the day was all about winning elections and not changing policy. And the censorship laws were seen as protecting our morals. So Chipp was, as we all know, a gutsy fellow himself, but he was very angry when John went in, and John was told he could be clapped in jail, and he knew he could be clapped in jail for bringing in a banned book. It was as crude as that. But John notified Chipp and went away and prepared with the other blokes from Penguin and the booksellers and everyone who was conniving in this, prepared a plan which was to print as many, as fast as possible, in great secrecy, 75,000 copies of Portnoy in paperback, and to do it really, really quickly. And they did. They managed to do it in 7 days and deliver them into the Penguin warehouse and out again overnight. The warehouse had to be clear of books by 8 o'clock in the morning when the police were notified, and out they came and charged John with releasing a banned publication.
But by then the books were on the road.
The books were on the road and they were very quickly in the shops and queues formed. The word was out very fast. It was extraordinary.
Why did you buy Portnoy's Complaint?
Well, I read about it in the paper this morning and I saw everyone queuing up in there and I thought it was absolutely hilarious and I'd buy a copy for Dad. Never let an opportunity like that go by.
But are you going to read it yourself?
Oh, yes, I should think so.
Was it the controversy over the publication of this that prompted you to go inside, do you think, and buy it? Or?
No, I was in there looking for a book of Jacobean tragedies, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Thorburn, I believe the police have been here this morning.
Yes, that is correct.
What did they do when they came?
They were very nice about it.
Do you think you're doing any harm at all by selling this book?
I don't think so.
Did the police indicate whether they'll be taking any action against you?
They merely said that they were not censors, they were policemen doing a job, and I would receive a summons later.
Well, you're still selling Portnoy's Complaint?
Yes, some copies did arrive after.
How many copies?
Well, quite a few.
How many copies have you sold now?
Getting close to 2,000.
Well, in the case of Portnoy's Complaint, there was one person in the queue who really wanted a copy. That was Patrick White.
Yes.
But he did come to the Melbourne trial and give
evidence.
He did, indeed.
I think he gave evidence in New South Wales as well, but I think the court case in Victoria was the first one. And Patrick came down. And I remember Patrick coming into court in a long black overcoat. Melbourne was freezing. It was August. In he came, looking like he was a British banker, and he stood in the dock, and he, with his wonderful deep voice, and he was interrogated in the way people were interrogated over filthy books in those days. You know, that was going to be a disastrous book that would harm young people and all that stuff. What did he think of the language? And I can hear him saying, "Nah, it's the kind of language that man would have used." And he was right. It was fabulous. It was a fabulous book.
And the courts went half and half. In the New South Wales case was particularly influential. We had two court cases. They were jury trials, which is also really extraordinary. And in both cases, the juries delivered hung verdicts. The juries couldn't decide whether it was an obscene book or not. And when those two verdicts were finally delivered, the then Customs Minister, Don Chipp, had to throw up his hands and say, "Oh, well, there's nothing more that can be done here. It has to be allowed to circulate." And that really was the last case that a literary book stood trial as such in Australia. It's the last case of a fiction book in particular being banned.
You had to challenge it, you had to ridicule it, and unless you were prepared to do this, we probably would still have this kind of censorship today. And it wasn't only censorship of literature, it was censorship of obviously erotica and crap, bad pornography, but also academic books. There was a general air of frustration. The country had grown up in the late 60s and we wanted out of that stuff.
At the same time, pockets of more radical anti-censorship activism were popping up. Young writers and university students who were as frustrated by the conservatism of the publishing world as they were by their inability to read or write banned literature. Frank Morehouse found that his early success as a writer dropped away when he began exploring more personal adult themes in his work.
My first attempt at short stories, I was very successful. I was published by the major literary magazines when I was 17 and 18. My traditional stories were accepted by those magazines. And then, of course, I was starting to write about, not in any erotic way, but I was writing about sex and love. And then the literary magazines in Australia, even, you know, the Meanjin and Southerly, said no, they couldn't publish this. And I remember Clem Christensen from Meanjin saying, you know, "You're a good short story writer," and they'd published some of my earlier, more tamer stories, and he said the printers wouldn't set this, so he could not get it published. And then there was about 7 years I continued to write and continued to explore sexuality and themes surrounding love and sex, and Desire, and I didn't get published again for about 7 years. No fun, my babe. No fun. Censorship was somehow part of the landscape, and it was only as my intellectual development continued that, and not only mine, many of my fellow writers, we started readings. We read in public where we could read anything we wanted to, and then we decided to hell with it. We'd publish uncensored stories, and we started little magazines, and the most important one was Thor, which grew out of the University of New South Wales. Wendy Bacon was the prime mover, and we published a supplement of banned writing and started to include banned writing, and gradually dawned on us that this couldn't go on, and this was madness, and it was distorting Australians' attitude towards sexuality, distorting the whole attitude to literature. And we started many rebellions.
If you think that there is more obscenity in war than in sex, in violence than in love, then CAAC is the people and place for you. The Committee for Action Against Censorship hold that individuals have the right to determine for themselves what they can read and what they can watch. CAAC will hold its first meeting in Central Lecture Block, Room 7.
Barbara Levy, who has been charged with selling Thor, February 71, will appear at Central Local Court for committal proceedings on March the 14th. On the same day, Andre Frankowitz will be tried for using indecent language, fuck the cops, outside Quarter Sessions Court, Darlinghurst, at the end of the Bacon-Cox trial on February the 11th. Maurie Isaacs will appear for both defendants.
What was it like to be living through that time when the Vice Squad presumably was raiding your house?
Yes, it was the Vice Squad would raid. I had the Little Red School Book, which was not a literary work, but a magazine about sexuality and contraception and things to be careful about and things that you shouldn't worry about and so on. And we handed those out to school kids. But there was a grave ignorance about sexual matters. I remember the Little Red School Book. One day I was just shopping in Woolworths and came out and the police were prizing open the back of the car because they'd looked in the car and there were some copies of Little Red School Book that I hadn't distributed, a pile in the back. And then when I came, they arrested me and they arrested my partner then. She'd been part of the campaign and we spent a few hours in jail and then we were released on bail.
Good evening. The last few weeks certainly haven't been kind to the federal censors, and especially to their chief, the Minister for Customs. The Little Red School Book has had a lot to do with it. Hardly a day has gone by without that book coming under fire. It's been criticised, and criticised strongly, by archbishops, by some of Mr. Chipp's ministerial colleagues, by the Labour Party's spokesman on education, and by DLP senators.
You don't perhaps think the book is anti-authoritarian for the sake of that?
No.
No, what it is anti-authority for the sake of being authority. And that's the distinction.
The kid should have as much knowledge as he can. It's just provoking his own individuality. It's not trying to make him anti-authoritarian or anything. It's just saying that he has rights too. Authority isn't all-powerful. And simply that he should question authority and he should question himself.
While I did not ban the importation of it, at the time I made my decision, I knew it was in fact on the printing presses in at least one state of the country. And all the copies being sold in Australia now were printed in Australia and therefore outside my jurisdiction. In fact, this was one of the reasons, one of them, not the only one, which motivated me not to ban it.
By the time it came to Australia, it was a worldwide sensation. And customs had to deliberate about it at great length about whether to ban it or not, knowing that there were moves afoot to publish it domestically. What made it a more scandalous instances that CHIP decided not to ban it. So it was a publicly offensive book notionally that Customs had decided not to ban. Understandably for CHIP, he had really no place else to go. He'd lost the teeth of his legislation, had been pulled. The Portnoy's complaint trials had meant any effective ban would be useless. But nevertheless, there was strong public opposition from members of his and members of his own party, of course, to this stance that CHIP took. And he described himself as sweating five lonely weeks before releasing it.
Because it is a provocative book, and I don't like being in the business of giving millions of dollars worth of free publicity to any publisher who wants to print something provocative. And I think Portnoy's complaint was a classic case of that. And this one, I've had some people estimate the value of the publicity that the Little Red School book has had, and they've come up with a figure like $3 million if you wanted to pay for it. That's what it would cost you.
Can I ask you, Lieba, about your parents' reaction? Have they read it already?
Yes, they have read it already, and they were very definitely approving of it, but I think my parents are somewhat exceptional to the case, and I think that most other parents would find it quite shocking and too frank.
Do you?
Yes.
Well, you don't then see that perhaps as a reason for some hesitation about letting it freely out into the community?
No, I don't think so. I think sometimes it's a very good thing that people are slightly shocked. And I mean, there's nothing in the book that is really shocking. It's just that I think that it'd be a very good thing if some people were slightly shocked for change.
At the same time, you also had activists actively campaigning to get it into schools. So the federal education minister swore that it wouldn't make it into schools, that he would work very hard not to get it into schools. But you had groups, including activists like Wendy Bacon, who'd already been active around the student newspaper Tharunka, and where a group of its editors had 40 obscenity charges brought against them in the New South Wales courts. So it came at a time where obscenity and censorship was in the news repeatedly.
Having published it, quite a number of us went out to schools one afternoon and we handed it out outside the schools. Now, lots of kids, in fact, knew about this, and they were just very glad to receive a copy. Most of the Little Red School book was really just information, again, that these days I think people would take for granted.
Wendy Bacon was editor at Tharunka, publishing Frank Morehouse and other writers like Frank Hardy, who were deliberately trying to knock down the walls of censorship. But they were part of a wider movement pushing all sorts of social boundaries.
Up until when we were doing Tharunka in 1970, we were at the University of New South Wales at that time. I think that most of the anti-censorship struggles in Australia had really been around trying to break down those customs borders, you know, trying to bring into Australia what was being blocked and what other people could get access to outside. That was really different from what we did, because there were a whole lot of young writers in Australia, not hundreds, but people like Frank Morehouse, Michael Wilding and others, who were producing really good work, but they couldn't get it published. So they were a backbone, in a sense, of what we did. But then you had the whole, a general radical politicisation happening. So, you know, we had Aboriginal land rights, we had women's liberation, we had gay liberation, and censorship was all part of that. And they were all movements about breaking through barriers. And so our movement really tapped into that. It wasn't so much saying, you know, here we are, these lovely middle-class audiences, and we can't get hold of this really quality material from outside. It's not that we didn't support that, but we didn't really come at it from that direction. We really came at it from a much more radical point of view.
Tharunka Special Supplement of Unacceptable Works, Volume 16, Number 6, Tuesday, 21st of April, 1970. Price, 10 cents. Eskimo Nell, which Tharunka intends to publish this week, lies in the long tradition of anonymous bawdy ballads, great favourites with rugby union players when they reach the bar after the game. Consequently, Nell should be known to a lot of parliamentarians, especially the Liberals.
By 1970, the editors of Tharunka were facing dozens of obscenity charges. In fact, Wendy was in court while the Portnoy's trial raged on next door. For them, the struggle went beyond the argument about literary merit.
Perhaps for pragmatic reasons, the arguments were this book should be allowed because it will be accessed by certain sorts of issues, certain sorts of audiences, it has literary merit. What we were trying to do is really sweep away not only censorship, but self-censorship. There was a huge amount of self-censorship going on in Australia. The literary magazines were part of that as well. And these writers like Frank Morehouse, Michael Wilding, Frank Hardy, Thomas Shepcott and others were actively failing to be able to push their work through because of these boundaries. So I think we really made a decision that we would break through the boundaries using direct action. And that is always, you know, I think a very successful tactic with censorship. And we also wanted to say that literature isn't just what's in acceptable publishers publishing acceptable books. It's not just in certain sorts of films. It's actually something much broader than that. It can be street poetry. Now, today, people would just take that for granted, that literature is a very big, broad field with overlapping boundaries. But then it wasn't really seen like that. It was seen, oh, there you've got all this radical trash and here you've got this literature. Well, I think now looking back on it, we were very, because that was our literature, we were very sort of keen to break down those boundaries. And so when we went into our second censorship trial, which was at the beginning of 1972, we were actually arguing, because of the way the laws were then, we were arguing that what we did had literary merit, but we were actually exploding the idea of literary merit. We were really doing a satire on it, and we were bringing gay liberation, women's liberation. Germaine Greer came over from Cambridge and she gave evidence about the language, and this was all, you know, very sort of acceptable language. And I just think that we were part of a much broader radical challenge. Stand up in an office, cool in the street, and this is what you gotta say.
Why don't you? Thurunka was busted again, and how? Wendy Bacon and John Cox are now in jail waiting to be sentenced next Friday. The show ran for 8 days at Darlinghurst Quarter Sessions. The prosecutor, for want of a case to put, impressed the jury by repeatedly waving his copy of Thurunka in the air. Wendy and John were charged under the Obscene and Indecent Publications Act with selling Thurunka November 70. They were facing 8 charges between them, guilty on the lot.
I would say it was lots of fun. I would say it was pretty exciting. I would say that when I actually, you know, I was really a fairly middle-class young student, you know, I was in my early 20s. I would say that when I ended up, you know, in the back of a prison van at 8:30 one night on my way to Mullewa Prison for a week, that was a bit of a shock. It was pretty unpleasant, but, you know, looking back on it, that wasn't really for that long. And, you know, my memories of it is a very exciting time involving lots of people. At the time, we probably did not give enough credit to the sort of long slog through campaigns like the Portnoy's Complaint campaign through the courts to break down the barriers to bring material into Australia. But at the same time, that wouldn't have itself been sufficient. And really what happened is that you had just a whole lot of people, not just student publications, you also had shops like the Third World Bookshop, you did have publishers, but then you just had a whole lot of student publications. And at the end of the day, the juries were not convicting. You know, the government realised that they had no way of getting these trials through the courts. And I think there was about, for Thurunka alone, I think there was something like 30 committed for trial. Were they going to have to put us on trial? And that just wasn't going to happen. And I think at that point they realised that they had to back off. So I think it was regarded at the time as a very successful campaign. And looking back on it, I think it was.
In 1973, the new Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam, and his Attorney General, Lionel Murphy, decided to end it all. Murphy, as both Attorney General and Customs Minister, gradually reduced his own power to seize and ban literature. Nicole Moore.
all the books on the banned list had been removed. And it wasn't done just by Murphy putting his hand in as minister and taking them off. He did ask the what was then called the National Literature Board of Review to review all the titles on the banned list and reconsider them in the light of contemporary standards. So that produced a very interesting set of reports and documents that I've seen, where you see these censors who themselves had banned the books then having to make arguments about why they should be taken off off the banned list. So that by the end of that year, the banned books of merit list had been reduced to zero.
I wouldn't say that we're entirely victorious, because actually censorship did continue after that, and there was a new regime set up, which involved, you know, much more things going into plastic wrappers, people deciding which classification they fell into, and I would say that led to most people being able to get the sort of sexual material they wanted. But it wasn't all an overnight thing. It actually was a gradual thing. And then I think, you know, there was a real lull in censorship. But then it did come up again in the 1990s. So I don't think that censorship is ever anything that people have actually won the battle. There'll always be a new battleground. Sometimes it will be in visual arts, as it has been at times. Sometimes it will be in political material. And so something like WikiLeaks really falls directly in what we would have loved to have been able to do then. I mean, if we got our hands on all those classified cables, we certainough would have published them.
Now, when Gough Whitlam's government reduced the list of banned books to zero, it has crept back up again. And though we think we live in enlightened times, there are still some publications that are banned in Australia, aren't there?
That's right, there are, on the basis of their offence of the classification code. And that includes, as some of your listeners will be aware, two jihadist books, which were banned in 2004 while the Howard government was implementing its anti-terrorism laws. They were banned for their incitement to crime, including terrorism. So those two books are still on the banned list, despite the fact that they were published in the early 1980s and despite the fact that they're easily accessible on the internet. Those two are quite notable books that have attracted a lot of queries and protests about the fact that they're on the banned list.
It's a statement more than it is an enforcement of a law.
That's right, yeah, and particularly those cases came on the back of a talkback radio campaign around them and a lot of reporting from the Daily Telegraph about their presence in Arabic bookshops in Western Sydney. So arguably it was a response to what could have been identified as public concern. So the government needed to be seen to be doing something rather than it effectively actually stopping access to those texts.
I wrote an essay for the Griffith Review called The Writer in a Time of Terror. That came out about 4 years ago. And in that I said that I didn't believe that there ever could be troubling censorship in Australia. But that essay concentrated on the national security issues. Remember that there had been the Bali bombing and so on, and there was a lot of fear about terrorism. And the Australian government that was under John Howard and Philip Ruddock brought in a huge amount of legislation restricting freedom of expression in Australia. Then the federal police and ASIO began raiding a publisher called Black Ink in Melbourne, which is still going and publishes the monthly. They raided that. They went into the Black Ink offices and they did what is called cleansing of the computers. And they went to a documentary filmmaker who was making a film about the book and they cleansed her computer. And they went to relatives of the author and cleansed their computers. And then the offices of The Australian were raided. The editor's office was raided. Radio stations were raided because they felt that some of the commentary was not in the national interest. And it just got right out of hand. And there are about 26, I think, cases like this at the time. And I thought, my God, censorship is coming back through another door.
I wish people, so many people, had have developed a passion and shown a passion for the real issues that affect the human race in this country. World hunger, racial prejudice, illiteracy, these sort of things. That if we could get people so as passionate in objecting about these other injustices as they are about sex, I think we'd be a far better and healthier community.
We're supposed to have a system that is rigorous, transparent, impartial, and notably that is the difference between now and the past, that we do have a banned list that is transparently available to us and we can check up to see what is on there and what isn't on there. And there are reporting mechanisms to tell us why books are banned, which is also an important part of us operating as a democracy as well. But nevertheless, there are controversial books that are banned for controversial reasons.
Historian Nicole Moore having the last word there. And for all the details of today's guests, as well as a list of publications and links, go to abc.net.au/radionational and follow the links to Hindsight. Our thanks to Hilary McPhee, Wendy Bacon, Frank Morehouse and Nicole Moore. And our sound engineer today was Mark Don. Next week on the program, another story of change and transition. This year was one for a major celestial event, the transit of Venus. Venus's orbit brought it directly between the Earth and the Sun, and millions of us witnessed it thanks to the internet. But only two people officially observed the first recorded transit 400 years ago.
One Sunday in late 1639, in the village of Muchhool, near Liverpool, England, Jeremiah Horrocks set about preparing for a great event, the first transit of Venus across the face of the Sun ever to be observed by human beings.
It was the 24th of November, 1639, and he had predicted 24th of November, 1639, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the Sun in November was going down at around 4 o'clock, so he had a very, very narrow window. And when 3 o'clock came, the sky was very cloudy. And I just can't imagine what he was feeling.
Sitting warm, wrapped with delight.
Horrocks arranged a telescope so that it projected the Sun's image onto a piece of paper in a darkened room. The image was 6 inches wide. The size of his room did not allow for anything larger. And on the piece of paper, he divided the circumference into degrees and the diameter into 30 equal parts.
And he must have watched and watched and watched the skies. But at 3:15, amazingly, the cloud dispersed. And he had half an hour when the light from the Sun came through his telescope, was projected onto the sheet that he'd set up in the room, and if he looked at the little disc of the Sun projected onto that sheet, he could just see this tiny, tiny black dot moving across the face of the Sun, which is an amazing thing. This is the first person ever, ever to see a planet move.
The transit of Venus next Sunday at 1 on Hindsight here on RN.